You know the mechanism already, right? Or some of you at least know. I will talk for a brief period of time so that there is enough space for the audience, for you to participate, comment, raise questions, argue with me or agree with me. I proposed yesterday that that a broad way of describing socialism was as a reaction of people to the existing social conditions that degraded them, or that degraded their humanity, that that were humiliating to them, to people, and that then that not only it was, as I said, an organic reaction, that it was also radical in the sense that it wasn't content just with attacking the symptoms, but that it went all the way to the sources of those problems. And I also made the point that the problems of that socialists have to solve are not yet resolved in theory, in principle. That these issues, the issues that have been raised by the historical experience of socialism, you know, the tragedies that have happened in China or in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, that those issues that have been dramatically presented by history haven't yet been fully resolved, but that to the extent that the existing society doesn't measure up to our best aspirations, that socialism was going to come back. It was going to bounce back. It could suffer defeats, but that it would come back, because it seemed to come from kind of the depths of our humanity, right? It's just that sense of unease that we feel when, you know, we enter our room and it's all disorganized, or, you know, when we see garbage in the streets or something like that. It's just that, you know, we immediately problematize the situation. We immediately visualize an alternative to that, you know, a clean street, a functional, well-organized room, etc. And that kind of moves us, right? That there is a passion involved, in the sense that we are almost like we suffer that passion, you know, that we need to do something about it. One of the social problems that I believe offends us the most is inequality. So I'm going to talk a little bit about inequality today, and then how, you know, the fact of inequality, right, the existence of profound asymmetries in wealth, in access to wealth, or in wealth ownership, in income, in consumption, etc., how that immediately raises in many of us, right, the vision of an alternative, a society that doesn't have those disparities, and so let me start with by showing you some facts that I just snatched from Wikipedia. Well, it's actually, these are relatively well sourced. I checked the sources, and they come from studies by, you know, United Nations agencies, World Bank agencies, etc. So it's not nothing completely, you know, far fetched. Moreover, I will say in parentheses quickly that I attend these seminars that are held at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York every year for college professors. I teach money and banking and those types of subjects at the college, and once a vice president of the Fed of New York introduced the definition of risk, systemic risk, and then with the source was Wikipedia. Yeah. So I think if the vice president of the Fed used Wikipedia as the reference, why not? Sure not. Okay. You can read it off. How access to wealth is incredibly unequally distributed. A very small portion of the human race has access, ownership of most of the productive wealth of the globe. And this manifests itself in international inequality. That means when you take averages for each country, for example, China, African countries, the United States, etc., and then you compare those averages across nations, and you see that there are these large disparities, tremendously large disparities between African countries, for example, and Switzerland or the United States. Switzerland is usually comes at the top, and domestically, also, in the United States, in the last 30 years, inequality has expanded tremendously. That is a fact. I mean, it has been shown using all kinds of data. Of course, the Census Bureau has its own statistics, but also using IRS data, which is highly reliable to some extent. There are always issues with handling data, but they paint a picture of expanding inequality in the United States in the last 30 years, a process that coincided with the erosion of unions, union organizing, union organizations, etc. Right, the dismantling of basic public services provided for the vulnerable, etc. A similar picture can be gleaned by looking at income data, right? Globally, this is for the entire globe. Some studies have been done by a very sharp economist from used to work for the World Bank, Branko Milanovic, and it's a very similar picture, right? Wealth is measured at a point in time, right? Like the value of your house, right? Now, income is like the wealth that flows from your ownership of that house. If you rent it out, then income will be your rent, right? Your rental receipts would be your income. So, or the only thing that you own is yourself, right? Your own ability to work, and you sell it in the labor market for a wage or a salary. Then that wage or salary is your income. It flows from your ownership over your labor power, right? Etc. If you own companies, if you own a stock, then your dividends, capital gains, etc., that is your income. So the income, because the income is ultimately determined by how income distribution is ultimately determined by how wealth ownership is distributed, then the picture is obviously very similar. There are these tremendous asymmetries. Now, there are all sorts of arguments about this, right? It is an obvious fact that nature doesn't endow individuals with the same characteristics, with the same attributes. We are different individuals, that we are not unique as a species. We see that, some chimpanzees are alpha males, right, as biologists would categorize them, etc., things like that. It's obvious that there is a certain range of natural diversity or biological diversity in our species, in the human species, right? But by the way, one of those icons or ideological icons of the conservative movement, Adam Smith, right, the Scottish philosopher or economist, right, one of the founders of the discipline of economics, in The Wealth of Nations, in the big book that he wrote, he made the claim that actually nature didn't distribute human talents in a very unequal way. That actually the range of variation of human talents when we are born tends to be not so wide, actually relatively narrow. That it is as a result of the division of labor, right? As a result of the fact that some of us specialize in doing certain tasks and other people specialize in doing others. Like, for example, you know, if you think of that in a hierarchical way rather than a horizontal way, right? Some people specialize in issuing commands, right? Giving orders, and other people specialize in following orders, right? Executing. Some people, specialize in thinking and, you know, planning, and other people specialize in executing those plans and actually carrying out the bulk of manual labor, etc. So according to Smith, it was the visual labor that it reinforced those differences and expanded them. It made them even bigger, to the point that when you look at an adult, you know, who started basically at the same level, you know, you will find tremendous disparities, you know, by any measure of performance. So the issue of nature is used by conservatives to say, well, you know, throwing their hands up, like, what can we do about it? You know, that is just a fact of life. We just have to, you know, accept it. You know, what can we do about that? Some people are smart, some people are stupid, that's it. I don't think that argument sticks because nature gives us many things. Like, nature gives us these mountains, but that nature doesn't dictate what use we're going to make of these mountains, right? We can turn these mountains into hollow mountains, right? We can extract from them minerals, etc., or we can decide, right? I mean, I'm not saying that it would be easy to reach that collective decision, right? But, you know, in principle, it's not completely, you know, out of the world to think that people could agree and say, let's preserve them as pristine as possible so that we can use them to, you know, for our enjoyment, recreational, etc., right? Or inspiration, you know, or, you know, relaxation, those things. So just because nature gives us something, that doesn't mean that we are predetermined in how, you know, that we're just going to accept what nature gives us. And I was saying yesterday that that it is just that intrinsic, that inherent characteristic of human beings as producers of their destiny, if you want to think in those terms, right? As producers of society, that we don't just accept what is given to us by history or by nature, but that we take it and we transform it. And because we want to shape up our environment in accordance with our design, with our ideas, with our dreams. And that by so doing, we also end up transform ourselves. So it seems I would coincide with Smith, with Adam Smith, who, by the way, said very nice things about the ability of markets to allocate, you know, the use of wealth. That most of the inequalities that we observe are the result of history. They are not, you know, embedded in our DNA, so to speak. Now, when you push a conservative, they will say, well, you know, I don't have a problem with equality of opportunities in principle. If it were possible to go against nature, right, against human nature, because human nature is so diverse. Some people are smart, some people are stupid. And then those who are smart are more likely to end up rich or, you know, etc. That's kind of arguments, right? But if you push them, they will say, okay, you know, it's, you know, of course, you know, it doesn't feel good to penalize babies because they choose the wrong parents or because they choose to be born in the wrong country. Right? Because we're saying that one of the big predictors of inequality is in which country you are born, in which country you live, right? Basically, by being born in the United States, it's like we won the lottery, right? In terms of, you know, the allocation of wealth in the world. You know, just by being born in the right country, you just happen to have, you know, you just happen to inherit an infrastructure, a certain stock of productive wealth that is just going to make you more productive of wealth and is just going to accrue to you in the form of income and access to consumption, etc. And it is something very clear when you look at immigration. When you take a Central American or Mexican worker and you just transport that individual, right, who is as hardworking in Mexico or in Central America he would be in a farm in Wisconsin. Right? But just by changing the setting, you know, you make that person much more productive or wealth. Right? Mm-hmm. And so it's clear that it doesn't have to do with, you know, your individual performance, or your individual performance may explain a little bit of the variation in outcomes, in the variation of results, right? But most of the variation of results seems to be conditioned by, well, precisely by those conditions that surround you, right? Anyways, but then, you know, conservatives will say, okay, let's give every baby the same opportunity to perform or to fail. You know, if they fail, you know, it will be their own, it will be the consequence of their own choices, and, you know, they are on their own. You know, well, I have no idea how you can disentangle, you know, opportunities from outcomes, because the opportunities of babies depend on, you know, the performance of their parents, the financial status or the economic status of their parents. It depends on the also on the community in which the family is embedded. You know, it depends on the general environment that surrounds them, the quality of the schools, the, you know, the etc. Right? The opportunities that are in the in that community, in that city, in that town, etc. So all those things would have to be equalized if you really want to give the same opportunity, right? You're going to give them a good shot to each baby, right, at life. Then, you know, you will have to press the reset button every time a baby is born. That means at every point in time. So that means that basically, you know, you will have to equalize outcomes. Now, I don't want to be too nonchalant about this. I think that the conservatives have a good point when they say, it really makes a lot of sense to me. I don't know what you think about this, when they say, well, the problem is that, you know, we don't want to reward people who are lazy, you know, people who just have the tendency to be parasites and to live at the expense of others. You know, usually I think of a parasite like somebody who just happens to be born with wealth and privilege. You know, it's just like collecting dividends. You know, that's usually what I think of as a parasite, right? But okay, let's suppose that, you know, I really will have a hard time finding individuals who like to be unemployed, who enjoy being unemployed and being poor, and that, you know, that they would rather be passively waiting for public or private charity to help them, to lift them up. I think that is really dehumanizing, that's really demoralizing, and it goes contrary to our, you know, more natural. If there is a human nature, I think that human nature would revolt, you know, at this attitude of just expecting that others give you without you contributing with anything. Even with kids, we notice that kids want to help. You know, they want to do the dishes. They see you that you are doing things, you are cleaning the house, and they want to help out right away, right?
For a while.
Yeah, absolutely. But then, you know, it probably is because of how we condition them, right? It's like, no, don't touch the glass. You're going to cut your fingers. And it's like, no, don't touch the water. It's gonna, you are concerned about their, you know, their safety.
No, they just find out that it's not really that much fun when they stop. Yeah, they really stop.
Well, you know, well, it's studies... Studies by sociologists, anthropologists, economists show that a lot of the well-being that we extract from life doesn't come from consumption. It's kind of curious, you know. It doesn't come. Consumption does make us feel good, but the well-being that we feel tends to be more lasting the more it takes for us to acquire that what we consume. You know, like psychologists make these differences between, like, what are the terms? Satisfaction. Satisfaction is when you make a little, make some effort, like a basketball player. You know, like, you know, scoring a point. You know, that's satisfaction that you feel. Happiness is a more prolonged, and happiness is associated. There is a motto that is written in the kiosk. I unfortunately cannot remember the precise phrase, but it's something about, you know, like I realize that a life of service, you know, it's happiness, right? Something like that. Somebody remembers exactly what it says. Well, anyways, so I think that a lot of our sense of well-being, our sense of identity as human beings comes from what we produce, the things that we do for a living. And some people even say that that even if we do a repetitive task, but if we do it with, you know, engaging our senses into it and trying to do things better, and kind of doing it for the right reason, the reward that we get is tremendous. I think there must be some truth to that. But just to come back to this, because I really want to give you an opportunity, equal opportunity to speak, right, is that, what was I going to say? That immediately, as you know, as we see inequality, right, we think of what could happen as a result of giving people, equal access or relatively equal access to wealth or similar opportunities. Oh, I'm sorry. This is what I was saying. I was recognizing that the conservatives have a point when they say that it is not helpful either to those individuals or to society to make those people into dependents, right? Dependents on the philanthropy or the help of society in a one-sided way without those people making any effort. I think that is definitely a good point, but I think that socialists, at least in the tradition of socialism with which I tend to identify, doesn't expect society to give individuals something just like that, living at the expense of others. Contrary to that, right? The idea is that socialists tend to believe that working people have in themselves, right? Because they have, they have humanity in them, right? That they have in themselves the ability to empower themselves and to liberate themselves, right? Except that, the powers that be, the status quo, tends to get very, very nervous when people take their destiny in their own hands, when people take action collectively, when people try to extract themselves from that situation of passivity and subordination and oppression and poverty. One of the most curious cases to me is the New York Times. In the New York Times, during the December holidays, you read these stories about, the needy and, why people should contribute to them and should help them. And they write these beautiful stories about people who are, just managing to make ends meet and surviving and trying to do things. And then, they invite private individuals, rich people, to lend them a hand, to, hand them out something. And people in other countries or people in the United States decide to not just, expect passively that the rich give them, but they demand it. They raise up and demand that their authorities, make an attempt to design their policies in such a way that they meet their needs, right? Their needs. Then when that happens, then that's wrong, right? Unions are incredibly discredited. Because obviously, they are working people, right? Working people make mistakes, and some people will incur in acts of corruption, etc. And there will be all sorts of malignant phenomena in a union, right? In the life of a union, no surprise, right? Human beings and under the conditions that exist, they are going to experience those things. We cannot expect perfection there. Now, when you see the sins of the rich are powerful, like for example, what just happened in 2007, 2008, right, with the excesses, the speculative excesses of banks, right? Then the approach is definitely different. About those. It seems like those excesses are measured with a different different standard. Okay, let me see if I can just wrap this up now. Well, I'll just say quickly that I believe that, even though the criterion of equity, right? The desirability of having an equitable society is a very powerful argument in favor of socialism. That I believe that the ultimate argument for socialism is efficiency, right? Which kind of surprises some people on the left, because they associate the term efficiency with, you know, profit making, you know, like extracting the most out of people or out of nature for private profit. Indeed, that is a sort of efficiency, right? But it's efficiency for the few. What I mean by efficiency is something much more expansive. But I mean efficiency, that is the proper management of wealth, right? And what is wealth for us and what is wealth for the few? And, you know, wealth for the few, it seems to me that that it translates into income, right? Income from wealth, income from capital, dividends, interest, that kind of income. For working people, most of their income, most of the income that working people earn is wages and salaries. So, but, you know, for us, what wealth would be is not necessarily what is profits, the maximum profits. For example, something that I noted yesterday, that environmentalists have been successful at shifting the notion of wealth to incorporate the need for preserving and enhancing the environment, right? To make sure that the environment is left for the next generations, right, to enjoy and to use. And so I think, and I will just cut myself short here, I think that a socialist society, right, would have to demonstrate in practice something that is not easy to accomplish, right, as we know based on the historical experience, but it will have to demonstrate in practice that is more efficient, right, better at managing productive wealth than the current system that we have in place. It will have to be better at producing wealth. Wealth redefined really to fit or to meet our needs, right? Incorporating, you know, not only, you know, environmental goods, but also social goods, right? Because what wealth should mean to us is ultimately our freedom as individuals, right? Our capacities, the development of our capacities as individuals, right? The society that can ensure that we can maximize our powers as individuals to express ourselves, you know, in our unique individuality. That is the type of society that I believe that we should aspire to. And so the society that proves to be more efficient in that sense, I think that's the one that will prevail. And it will have to be more efficient because it has to defend itself against, also against the backlash, right? Mm-hmm. From the forces that want to preserve the status quo. And I will stop there. Thank you. Yes, please, Michael.
Given what you've just said, does that mean that instead of talking about GDP, we should do as Nepal and others are doing and talk about the gross happiness product? No, that's a serious
problem. Yeah, absolutely.
There are people working very seriously on that. I mean, that's a serious question.
Yes, there is an economist. There are many economists who have been experimenting a little bit with this, right? At first, you know, when I first, in the 1980s, 1990s, when I first started to hear this argument, you know, we should redefine wealth, we should, you know, we should adjust the GDP, because the GDP, the gross domestic product, which is a measure of the output that is produced in a society in a given year, right? The final output, that's how economists call it, right? The final output that is traded in organized markets. It has all those qualifications, but you know, it's a measure of the wealth that we produce over a period of time, the output of our, you know, labor, etc., the use of our productive wealth. There are many things that are not included in the GDP, and they should be in the GDP. And there are many things that are added to the GDP that should actually be subtracted from the GDP. Right? Like, for example, if there is a spillover of a chemical on the road and it has to be cleaned up, that is added to GDP. Hmm. Well, all we are doing is just cleaning up a mess that we made, right? A mess that actually subtract welfare. It doesn't add welfare, right? It doesn't add well-being. So it's a subtraction of wealth that's added to GDP because it's the income of that company that provides those services of cleaning up the spillover. On the other hand, you know, if you provide healthcare for profit, right? You have a business that provides healthcare, that counts as part of GDP. But if you stay at home and you take care of your children and the children of your neighbor, then that doesn't count as GDP. Even though your care may be as good, if not better, than the care provided in a private establishment, etc. There are many issues with GDP like that. But economists have been discontent with that. But more serious efforts have been made more recently. There was a commission that was pushed by the president of France, Sarkozy, and an economist that I respect a lot, Joseph Stiglitz. He's a professor of economics at Columbia University, and he won the Nobel Prize for his work in economics. And he is one of those who have been arguing for the need to measure our output differently. Right? Economists say what we should measure is welfare, but we don't have good measures of welfare, so we use as proxy the amount of stuff that we produce. Even though sometimes the amount of stuff that we produce actually subtracts welfare, right? But you know, economists sometimes argue and say, well, over time, if you look at how stuff moves and how welfare moves, then they tend to move together. It is not true, actually. There have been studies by some economists that show that welfare or measures of happiness or you know whatever approximation that we have to how well we feel about ourselves, right? As a result of what we do, as a result of what we eat, as a result of what we enjoy, etc. It you know, as we increase our wealth to over $10,000 a year, right? Professor, I was talking to Connie just a while ago, and I told her that I took all the courses that Professor Robert Heilbronner taught at the New School History of Economic Ideas. He's the author of books that are well known, right? And he used to say, wealth or income, money, is not the solution to all problems, but the lack of money tends to be very problematic, right? So indeed, that's what the studies show, that if you have an income below 10,000, if you go from zero to 10,000, the level of well-being shoots up, right? It goes up very rapidly. Then when you pass the $10,000 mark, and I'm talking about dollars of 2,000, then as you expand your income, then the bang that you get in welfare for the buck decreases and decreases and decreases to the point of becoming flat. That means that you're just getting rich for the sake of getting rich because you are not really having a better quality of life at a certain point, right? You know, I think $10,000 may seem like very little to us Americans, but those studies are international. So, you know, like, in other countries, $10,000 a year is a lot of money. It's a very high income.
Somebody came up with a figure for Americans too.
50 or 60,000.
Yeah. 50 or 60,000 and
flattens out at around 50 or 60,000.
So it's very similar pattern, right? Yes. I don't know, Michael, if that addressed you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but that is a good effort, I think. You know, whatever moves us in that direction of knowing what we are producing, right? And then adding what really contributes to our well-being. For example, friendship, which is a good, right? It's wealth, right? And the production of friendship is sacrificed tremendously because we overwork ourselves, right? Because we work overtime, because the couple in a family, in a typical family in the US, tends to work, right? And then we are sacrificing relationships with our neighbors, with our friends, with our spouses, right, for the sake of producing this thing that is measured as wealth, right? And so because that doesn't count as part of GDP, then we don't consider it wealth, right? The experience of eating an apple, that's what we consider, as something that yields welfare to us, right, through consumption. I'll stop here. I think we have time, right?
Mm-hmm. Really? Mm-hmm. See, on the subject of wealth inequality, I mean, a lot of the issues that come up have to do with people's tendency to compare themselves against other people. And it's not, you know, you don't, and that gets, you know, along, that fits right in with the idea of the leveling off of happiness with wealth, is because you're just finding a higher quality of people to compare yourself to, or higher standard that you set up against. You don't, you're a millionaire, you don't feel like very wealthy because, you know, your neighbor has is 2 million, and then it just keeps on going on from there. And but it's sort of a common human tendency to do that, even in societies that tend to prevent it, like in communist China, even where you had situations where people were generally put at the same level, it often arose, that, you know, small differences get really magnified in terms of they have just a little bit more of this, or access to a little bit more of this, and it causes a lot of anxiety in people. So it's very, you know, it's a quandary trying to, you know, we decide to have a society that's a little bit more equitable, but it's almost an impossible goal in the sense of people are always going to have different perceptions. This person's not working as hard for what he's getting, or he's getting a little bit more, but he's not working harder for it. So how do you balance that, or how do you get past the idea that it has to be one or the other? I mean, I think it's a big challenge between socialism and capitalism. You try to drive this big stake down the middle and say, okay, it's got to be completely capitalism, like a libertarian, and if it's not that, it's going to be communism, or it's going to be, you know, something over here that gets demonized on, you know, right-wing radio or something. So how do we bridge that kind of chasm and say, okay, there's got to be some way we can design a society in the middle that provides, you know, a little bit of each side.
Yeah, that is an interesting point. Let's suppose, just for the sake of argument, that it is in our DNA to be competitive with one another, and that we pursue, you know, this to be the first place in the pecking order, and that we want to be above the rest. Let's suppose that that's really rooted in our biology. Right? I go back to this issue of, you know, I'm yielding in the argument a lot because the studies show that social conditioning is very important. Mm-hmm. When people live in a neighborhood, I think, you know, those millionaires that don't feel happy because they choose to live in the Upper East Side of Manhattan, right? Because, you know, they are going to be forced to compare themselves with people that, for sure, some of them are going to be richer than them, and they're going to be miserable as a result, right? I go back to this to this idea of, again, assuming away the social conditioning, assuming that it's just natural in us, that just because something is endowed by nature to humans, that doesn't mean that we have to take it as is. I was recently reading to my son this book by story by Jack London. Not so recently, it was early this year, but he was reading the White Fang book, right, by Jack London, and he describes the story of a dog who, since the dog was, you know, it was the son, the child of a she wolf, of a wolf and a she wolf, I think. And then it was semi-domesticated, mistreated, like brutally treated by humans. And then there is this human being, and I think this story is realistic. I know it's fiction, right? But very realistically depicted. this individual, noble man, who decides to give the benefit of the doubt to the dog and treat the dog in a humane way. And kind of expecting the best of the dog. The dog bites him at first because it's like totally feral. Mm-hmm. And but then little by little the dog responds to that. And it's I think 70% or at least 50% wolf, wild wolf. And at the end of the story, you know, the dog comes around to, you know, establishing a good relationship with this guy. And I just think to myself, if dogs, right, can change over their lifetime, you know, forget about over generations, right? Because if we raise our kids and then our grandkids, you know, in accordance to certain values and principles in a certain setting, on social conditions that foster, you know, mutual solidarity rather than envious feelings, etc., right? Then I think that we can pretty much design the personality of, you know, our offspring, you know, in a, I think that is also consistent with our human nature.
But then what's the blueprint for that design? Because you have the examples of the top-down approach where the society says, okay, you're all equal, and it doesn't work for a lot of reasons. And then you have, you know, the other side which says, well, all men are created equal, but not really, and you know, so it's a race to the top, and that, you know, certainly doesn't get us to any kind of, you know, equality state. So how would you design a society that sort of directs us to that goal without sort of top-down?
Can you tell me the time? I just want to stick
it's
to the...
Five to seven.
Okay, we have plenty of time. Okay. I want to, if I can plug my next conversation is better. Right? I'm going to discuss this issue of social structures versus agency, our ability to change social structures. But at this point, let me just say that that we have to be careful about identifying what is really, as the sophists, Greek philosophers put it, right, given by Zeus, the god,
Zeus,
the god of gods, right, Zeus, versus that is granted to us by Prometheus, meaning, you know, what is natural, what is in our human nature versus what is what is social convention. And institutions that for a long while, you know, for example, in ancient Greece, thinkers, very profound thinkers, thought that the institution of slavery was natural. Mm-hmm. You know, just owning as a human being and making that human being do things for you, you know, as you would with a non-human, right, with an animal or a horse or, you know, cattle or something like that, with a dog. It was regarded as natural, as a natural institution. It took a shift, a tectonic shift in the consciousness of the human race to go beyond that, right, and to be able to say no. This is not a natural institution. We don't have to accept. We can do better than this. We can do better than slavery. So I don't know how long is it going to take for human beings to overcome capitalism, or if we will at the end of the day, because there is also we also have the ability to self-destruct. I think we have the ability to reform ourselves, but also we have the ability to destroy ourselves. So, but I don't know how long it's going to take. But I'm pretty sure that at some point, some generation, if we survive as a race, as a species, some future generation is going to look back and say, you know, how did we ever think that was, you know, inherent to our human nature? You know, definitely we could do better than that. I don't know why my ancestors thought that. And they're going to think of these institutions as unnatural, as offensive to humanity, I think. But that is to be decided. I understand that there are that those kind of sentiments are ingrained in a large, even in people who think of themselves as socialists. I will admit it. Sometimes I feel envious when I see somebody who is, you know, who has more access to certain resources, to certain things than me. If I see somebody like using a better computer, you know, I do indulge in those feelings. But I think that I could overcome them, right? It's a little bit of a chicken and egg thing, right? I feel them because I know that everybody else also feels that. But then if we all, you know, manage to overcome this gridlock, then I think I can overcome them. Yes.
When you put the word efficiency up before, would you include, when you said better management of wealth, would you include in that better use of human potential? Because it seems that we believe that poor countries are poor because the people are of an inferior sort. We know the ground has different amounts of natural resources. We know that Norway has North Sea oil and Malawi does not, or at least last I heard they didn't, Sudan does not. But I think, especially from the point of privileged place in the world that we sit as Americans, I think we sometimes believe that intelligence is not distributed randomly across the whole planet. I had a really big wake-up moment when I was talking with a paleontologist a long time ago, and he said, if you took a person at the very moment that Homo sapiens made the breakthrough to be Homo sapiens, if you took such a baby, put it in a cradle in Madison, Wisconsin, and raised that baby, it would be the identical person. It would be a baby of this time because there has been no evolutionary change since Homo sapiens arrived. And the best minds of Homo sapiens in the Ice Age or at the very dawn was deciding how to make a better point. Those people are now designing bridges or they're designing spaceships or they're designing Apple computers. It's randomly distributed over the whole planet, I think, and we're wasting huge amounts. In some societies, all the women and an awful lot of the men. It seems a terrible waste of the human race's ability to solve problems. We're throwing it away as if it was garbage. I thought that's what you were going to be saying about.
Well, but you said
efficiency.
It. So I'm glad you said it because it's an excellent point. It's an excellent point to make, right? That every baby that doesn't develop his or her full potential, it's part of the cost that we are paying for the kind of society that we have. And to the extent that we are capable of doing better than that, yes.
But there's a responsibility of every culture and society to understand their greatest asset. Are there people?
Is there people?
And I don't believe that you can broadly say society as a world community is the same everywhere. That's clearly not the case.
No.
So it's the responsibility of at a national level of a country and a people to understand the implicit gift they're given through their own people. And the more that we can expose that is maybe the best we can do. We can't live other people's lives, right? We cannot do that. I don't see how,
right?
So I think to the extent that we can foster a world where human rights are lifted up as a key aspect and expose the places where human rights have obviously been violated is a heck of a good step in the right direction.
That brings up, though, I agree completely with what Jim said. Is that triggered in my mind, the thought is, you know, often we say we believe and we want to do what Jim said, but other things get in the way that are in our, we think are in our best interest. So we don't do what Jim said, because if we do that, then certain countries, certain cultures, certain people will behave differently towards us and that will impact us, if we perceive to be a negative impact. Does that make sense?
Numbers are getting up in the right.
Well, or our national interest will be threatened somewhere.
Right.
Yes, please.
Yeah, NAFTA is an example of this. Regardless of, you know, through which lens you see NAFTA, my sense anyway, in my understanding of how that's played out, it's a good example of how our national policy has benefited the United States. And certainly the people in North America that the treaty involves all, you know, were brought into this world with similar gifts. But we Americans have stacked the deck with policy. And the thing that I struggle with trying to understand, how can I as an individual, and this maybe gets to your next lecture, you know, how can we as individuals participate in a system that is so gamed that it seems impossible to have policy different from NAFTA, for instance, that really, you know, is creating horrible inequity and is sustaining and taking advantage of our assumptions about the origins of inequality in the world. I mean, we have this, you know, we wealthy European and Americans have this kind of arrogance where I had an epiphany reading Jared Diamond, Guns, Germs, and Steel.
Yeah.
And that for me was the realization that we aren't smarter. That's not why we're here. Our society prevailed over Native American society, not because it's better, but because of a bunch of accidental combinations of resources and traits. Some good, some bad. They're all just a soup of traits created a society that defeated another one. We're not better. So, you know, how do we as individuals, applying that kind of knowledge, change our system in support of equality to allow those other people in other parts of the world to reach their full potential? Because they can't, in poor countries, compete with us if we wield our full power to game the system.
And unfortunately, NAFTA doesn't benefit everybody in America, it just benefits the rich. How many of us working people have seen job? Basically, it pits us working people against the working people in other countries, like Mexico here, or Canada. How many of us have seen jobs go down there when it would probably have been better to develop their own jobs doing the thing? I mean, I have another question. I consider myself moderately socialist. I actually am a member of the Democratic Socialists of America. But there's been all this, but in the supposedly historically socialist countries, there's been all this, they've violated human rights like crazy, just every one of them. And I can't, and it's very hard to, that's one reason, of the main reasons that people have been, socialism has a bad name here. And I'm having a lot of trouble even, I mean, I'm even scared to even think of myself as a socialist. Also, socialism has a tendency to be identified by society as somehow meaning you're some kind of dogmatist and of course, that only applies when you're not, the majority does have a dogma, it's this free market thing. Everybody believes in it. You're considered somehow, nobody talks about that being a dogmatic system either.
I'll try to use this to wrap this up quickly. One of the consequences of inequality is that the mechanisms through which people negotiate their interests, like for example markets, are vitiated from the beginning, from the start. If people were on equal footing and they decided that, you know, I'm going to cooperate with you, if you cooperate with me, but the rate at which I help you to the rate at which you help me is going to be determined by the haggling of the people who supply on this side versus those that supply on the other side. In other words, the price is going to be the ratio at which I'm going to help you versus what you are going to help me. If we consider that the fair rate of the price is set by the market, then, you know, if you are in conditions of relative equality, then that should be fine. I mean, it's win-win, right? I help you, you help me. You know, you give me a gallon of milk, I give you $3, right? The problem is when there is asymmetry. Mm-hmm. In the initial conditions are not equal. In that case, markets have a big problem. Markets tend to fail. In markets become like a disguise of the abuse of the powerful, of the weak by the powerful. And it's not only markets. Any other, like for example, political systems like democracies, for example, electoral democracies like the US is another case. When John McCain and Russ Feingold had this initiative to legislate, you know, big money out of the you know, influencing the electoral process, right? To some extent, right? Curtail it. The case was brought to the Supreme Court, and Antonin Scalia told the lawyer that defended the bill, you know that, you know, councilman, that water will always flow down. In other words, it doesn't matter how many legal obstacles you pose to big money is fungible. It's going to find its way towards influencing the outcome of the elections. And of course, you know, that it doesn't follow, right? That people shouldn't try to place obstacles, legal obstacles, to that influence, right? But he was making the argument, you know, why should you care if it's going to find its way anyway? There are going to be loopholes, and rich people are going to find them anyway, right? So money is like speech, right? So it should be contributing to campaigns is free speech, etc. You know all that story. So, but the other thing that I may have forgotten, the other thing I was going to say. So I think that's good, because that way we can just talk. Okay.
Well, I just, listening to people talking, I had a question about borders, boundaries, nations, and what that would look like. Because it feels like a lot of people here, myself included, are looking at what is the global good? What is the global humanity? And how economically does that work? But the truth is, right now, we're dealing with a whole bunch of nations, nation states, that have different economic systems on the globe. And it sounds like that's part of what the problem is that's creating this inequality. So either, can you speak to that for a few minutes?
Okay, that will be in future, but I will say something about it, but I just remember what I was going to say. That, you know, the tragedies of the historical experience of socialism, right? They were the result of, you know, they couldn't do better. On the one hand, they were forced by circumstances, and on the other hand, they made mistakes, big, huge mistakes. So it's a combination of those two. I'm not a historian. I have studied a little bit of the history of the Soviet Union, a little bit of China, etc. But it would be the work of a serious historian, right, to disentangle what was imposed by the constraints on which those experiments were carried out, right? And what was the result of the stupidity of individuals, or the evil, right? The sheer, madness of a particular set of individuals or a particular individual, right? Be it Stalin or Mao Zedong or whoever. You know, I'm not gonna get into the exercise of trying to see is that relevant to the case of the United States? We are going to make our fair share of errors, right? And we are going to be under a different set of constraints, right? So I think that's why, you know, we have to be careful about how we translate that experience to our own. We should try and learn from the experience of others, but it doesn't necessarily translate easily, because we have a different, you know, the U.S. has its own history, etc. And by the way, just to talk a little bit about what the gentleman back there said, we have to recognize that, you know, even a giant, a genius like Isaac Newton, right, once said that we are standing on the shoulders of giants, right? Actually, we look back and we see the contributions of, you know, generations after generations of thinkers. We see that our contribution to the wisdom of the human race is just marginal. You know, somebody like Newton thought so. So I think that when we look at if we study our history, we study the history of the United States, we will see that we are standing on the shoulders of giants, and sometimes shoulders that weren't voluntarily, you know, given to us for us to stand on, but that were, we forced them to place their shoulders there so that we could step on them and build our thing, right? So, and then no wonder, you know, if we have better conditions, we are expected to show better results, right? So that is not to underestimate our own individual talents and contributions and all that, which I believe, you know, that they do exist because of this natural diversity among individuals that I mentioned at the beginning. I will. The history of the existence of nation states, right? Well, you know, human beings have organized themselves in different types of communities. And the specifically political forms of community, what we would now call states, right, like in ancient Greece or, you know, ancient Mesopotamia, etc., and Egypt, right, India, China, etc., they are relatively recent creations. For if human beings have been on Earth, Homo sapiens have been on Earth for, I don't know, like perhaps some people say up to 1 million years, right, humans have been here. For most of that period of time, the institutions like markets, institutions like governments, states, didn't exist. So they are relatively new creations. And people lived hand to mouth. And nation states are even more recent. They just go back to the 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th century. And in some cases, like in the case of Africa, like actual independent nation states are the result of anti-colonial struggles more recent in the 20th century. So these are definitely transient institutions. They are not carved in stone. You know, they are not in our DNA. We can change those things. It is entirely possible for us to, and maybe necessary, like for example, to cope with these environmental challenges. It may be necessary that we start to think globally, right? As kind of the same type of entity, except that with different skin color and, you know, other characteristics. And I will stop there. Thank you so much.